God, we've got to do something. The little Arvin's, oh my goodness.
Bitch almost had me going get an Arvin. People in Mississippi, white folks in Georgia and shit, adopting babies. Shit gonna last about a year. And that racism gonna come out. God damn. What in the hell we got here, Margo? Ain't your eyes ever gonna round up? Look like one of the neighborhood coons. And I'm for orphans now, you know, don't get me wrong. I like orphans, but shit, they got 10 million niggas here need to be adopted. They got a show in L.A. on TV. They be selling niggas for adoption on the TV. You ever see those shows? Get one of these niggas, please. What's the big head one here? He's all right. I'd take him home, but I have a dog. Got all the Vietnamese in the army camps and shit, taking tests and stuff, learning how to say nigga. So they can become good citizens.
All right, so we're good to go. All right. Hey, this is Jason Klom. This is episode number 4 of Comedy on Vinyl. And this week we are going to be doing Is It Something I Said by Richard Pryor. Do I sound all right?
Mark? Yeah, yeah.
All right. And with me, as usual, is Mike Warden.
Hello.
And as not usual, Mike Priester.
How's everybody doing?
Let's wait for the response.
We get a good response usually on that.
Yeah, this time I don't know what's
really?
Going on.
They're awfully quiet out there.
Yeah, it's very strange.
How come they respond to Richard Pryor so well that we get nothing?
I know, what the fuck? So I'm not familiar with this record that much, so I listened to it today for the first time, I'm embarrassed to say. But I mean, I know enough Richard Pryor from the films and a few other albums. But I don't know, Mike, just tell us what this album means to you.
When you asked me about vinyl, I mean, this Richard Pryor is who came to me, and doing a little bit of research since then, I remember being, you know, in ninth grade or 10th grade, somewhere along there, and I can't even honestly remember why I bought a Richard Pryor album.
Right.
You know, I'm sure I had seen him somewhere, and this was in the late 70s, and, you know, he was well known, but I think I had just seen bits, and I'm sure nobody at my house had a Richard Pryor album.
Right.
And when I put it on, you know, it was like gold, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just like I'd never heard anything like this. I'd never seen anything like this. And he paints such a picture with words, you know.
Yeah.
I'd never seen him. I'm guessing I'd seen him on TV, but certainly never seen him in concert.
Sure.
And even listening to little bits we were here before and that we'll see here, you know, he creates this image in your mind where, you know, we've seen enough of him here and there that we can tell what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, that it's making you laugh because you know there's something funny going on.
Yeah.
You can hear an audience response. Or sometimes you're just wondering, you know, I wish I could see live what or see a recording of what he was actually doing during some of these bits.
Right.
He's doing something that's setting the audience off big time, you know?
Do you think, I mean, I don't know if there are concert movies of this. Like, do you have any idea?
I know that there is footage of When a Woman Leaves You. That
okay.
On YouTube, you can kind of see part of it and stuff, too.
Okay.
You can see him doing that one. And I don't know about any other particular bits from here,
okay.
From this album.
Pretty good. And you were, so you grew up in Nebraska, right?
I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and honestly, you know, in a very, you know, white neighborhood and had very little, you know, exposure to any type of, you know, ethnicity or, you know, beyond like Italian. That was like, you know, going, you know, overboard for us.
Right.
You know, that was the ethnicity, you know, of the neighborhood that I grew up in. And it really was, you know, an exposure that was interesting. And I also knew, you know, I had that sense that I knew he was doing things I couldn't do as a, you know, as wanting to be a comedian as well. You know, I mean, you and I were talking about, it's still shocking to hear him throwing out, you know, the N-word and, you know, and the language he uses and talking about pussy and, you know, and it's like, if somebody's not ready for that, you know, if that's not your cup of tea, Richard Pryor, you know, isn't the person for you.
Right.
But he's, you know, he's just an amazing guy, and just having done a little bit of research and seeing that, you know, Comedy Central voted him the all-time greatest stand-up comedian.
Did
and
they?
For me,
That's
yeah,
awesome.
You know,
awesome.
it's absolutely true for me. I mean, there are, you can see, you know, bits of, you know, Bill Cosby performances that make you laugh so hard, you know,
right.
And Steve Martin, I know you've heard a lot, and I listened to a lot as a kid, as a stand-up, he was, you know, pretty special, you
sure,
know.
Sure.
But Richard Pryor, for me, is just, he's the man. He's the one who sits out and, you know, stands out and up and above. And just, you know, I know a lot of people put stock in Lenny Bruce, and I right. know he opened doors and sure. did things that people hadn't done before.
Sure.
But it's Pryor, you know who I think really hit the pinnacle.
Yeah, I mean, like, Lenny Bruce, I mean, at the very least, language-wise, I guess right. he opened doors, but he wasn't right. a character guy too
right.
much.
Right, right.
You know, it was just much, I mean, he was like, he was also broke lines as far as racial barriers. Mm-hmm. He would do all kinds of satire about race. But yeah, he wasn't a character guy, and that's what, for me, at least, connects to people yeah. the most. And that's, again, like Chris Rock. Even Chris Rock talks a lot. I mean, his characters are not a thing you find as right. much unless it's, like, a bit or right. a gimmick. Like, yeah, I don't know, Mike. What do you think?
No, that's exactly right. What I love about Pryor is that he takes you to a place where you're really on the verge of being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, and Lenny Bruce did that, too. But mm-hmm. this is, sometimes Lenny Bruce did make a lot of the people feel uncomfortable,
oh,
and,
yeah.
and that was why he had some backlash. But he takes you to that point where he's like, no, it's okay to think about this. It's okay to laugh about this. That's what comedy is. That's mm-hmm. that's what really gets it for me.
Seeing some of the things he went through in his life, too, and seeing that he had visited Africa in, I think, 79, mm-hmm. and he, you know, stopped using the N-word, you know, after that, and hearing, you know, all these albums, the 70s was his heyday album-wise and stuff,
right.
and they're, you know, N-word laden,
yeah.
you know, I
yeah.
mean, you know, and that's it, and knowing that he changed and later on, you know, stopped doing it,
sure.
too, is something I think people have to keep in mind that, you know, he had a change, too, in his attitude towards the word itself.
Right.
And, you know, it's, you know, obviously the country has,
sure.
you know?
Sure, to me, I mean, I don't even hear it anymore if I hear a comic that uses it a lot. I don't hear it because I just, like, I guess I zone it out. Then
right.
or I turn the comic off for the
right.
most part because
right.
I don't care unless you're using it to make a point,
right.
which nobody is anymore.
Right.
And maybe he wasn't doing it to make a point, but he was reflecting a culture that existed. And now, you know, most American culture's become a fucking parody of itself anyway, so I can't take it seriously. Then it's like, you know what? We are black people. That it was just post-civil rights. Civil rights didn't quite work out the way we hoped. You know, not to make it too serious. But, I mean, at this point, I don't know. The word gets so overused, it has no impact
yeah.
anymore. And there, it doesn't even shock me. Doesn't even shock me. I don't think. It just annoys me, you know, for the most part.
Agreed.
And, I mean, Mike Warden and I are both from upstate New York, too. I don't know what your experience was ethnically, Mike, but mine was very white as well.
Very, very white,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so
yeah,
it's
yeah.
three white guys talking about Richard Pryor. That's what we're going to call this episode, actually.
I did listen to my fair share of Tupac
okay.
in high school, uh-huh. so I was actually, they called me a wigger in mm-hmm. high school was
oh, okay.
my name.
Oh,
yeah,
okay,
yeah,
right,
yeah, yeah.
Right. Because you
yeah.
wanted to listen to different things.
Because I listened to different things.
Oh, that's
so,
exciting.
Yeah, yeah, but Richard Pryor, especially me, was is in comedy, is the number one influence that I had. I listened
yeah.
to everything, and it's funny that I don't know much about this album, but the other, his other stuff, it was on vinyl in my parents' mm-hmm. attic, because that was the stuff I wasn't allowed to listen
oh,
to up until a certain age. I could
so
listen
fun.
To the Bill Cosby stuff as much as I wanted,
right.
but...
You know, that made me think of something, too, is that now, somebody who's in high school, if they want to get a hold of this, probably can't, because
mm-hmm.
it would have a stamp, you know,
right.
you know,
yeah.
You know, you have to be probably 17, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And I'm sure my parents had no idea I was up there with the Richard Pryor album. You know, my parents are a lot of fun, but I don't know. You know, we had seven kids, so
uh-huh.
it was hard to maintain who was doing what at any given
yeah.
time, right? You know?
Yeah.
So I was up there with Richard Pryor albums and hearing this stuff that I'm sure if they really knew,
yeah.
they would not have wanted me to. But,
right.
you know, it really is one of the first big influences in comedy in my life.
Made me mad too, Jack. You know, I said, get that motherfucker 40 years. That's cold blooded. So you motherfucker sentenced me, but he ain't gonna get my dignity. Kiss my ass, Jack. Step right up there. Shit. I said, what it is? Huh? Run it down. Judge said, what are you doing the next couple of months, Mr. Pryor? Well, I'll be helping crippled children and anything I can for humanity, sir. I had my pants all down by my ankles when he was finishing. Just don't stick it in too far, Your Honor, please.
You know,
yeah.
and besides, my parents have terrific senses of humor.
Sure.
You know, he was the one who kind of showed me, you know, character work and crafting jokes and,
mm-hmm.
you know, and playing to an audience, because he gets audiences, you know, eating out of his hand on these. You know, he's such a so charismatic, it's unbelievable.
Did you ever do any stand-up?
I did. I did. Yeah. I did stand-up, too. I was more of a sketch comedy person, was my favorite, you know. But at times when you couldn't get people together, I was doing stand-up. But, you know, when Richard Pryor is your hero, you know, how do you live up to that? You know, I mean, you know, I had... I did some traveling just around the Midwest and stuff, you know, but I preferred writing, you know, preferred group work. So I, you know, really wasn't a full-fledged stand-up comedian. You know, I never called myself, you know, a stand-up comedian. It was more a chance to get on stage and, and to write stuff and put, you know, put material out in front of an audience to hear it get a response.
Right.
That's why I shot lower. Dave Coulier is my hero. I was like, I'm not going to say Richard Pryor's my hero, because then I don't have anywhere to go.
I know, right? How do you look?
How's your Bullwinkle? That's my question. Yeah.
Not good. That's what threw it off. I was
it's Coulier good.
Oh my God. But you know, he did sleep with Alanis Morissette.
I know. That's the first thing that comes to my mind, too, when you think you can't ever, like, you know, sell him short for
anything.
You missed it at home, but he did faithfully the hand gesture. So thank you for that. You made made someone say it. I'm trying to think, because, I mean, Richard Pryor for me, my first exposure is probably just the movies. Because I listened to unintentionally mostly white comedians growing up, just because that's all my parents had, was a bunch of white people.
And also, that's predominantly what was on TV at the time, too. Sure. You know, it was harder as a minority to get on.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think they ever... Also, they didn't want me listening to the N-word until I was old enough to get when it was being... How it was being used, that I was not allowed to use it. Because I did use it once when I was six, because I didn't know what the word was. I'd heard it, and my dad, they did not beat me, but he spanked the shit out of me that day. He's like... What did you just say? I'm like, I don't know. I have no idea what the word means. I just, some kid at school said it. And so I said it too. And I never said it again after that. Well, I won't say never now. Yeah, I can use it academically, even though I'm still mostly uncomfortable with it.
Right.
But I don't know. My exposure to him was through the movies. So it's, but every time I hear him, it's just, it is. Like you said, it's new and fresh to me. But I mean, it's new and fresh to you. And it's still like one of the first things.
We were talking about Blazing Saddles too. And that he would, you know, helped with the writing on that. And you can definitely tell, you know, of all the things. I mean, Mel Brooks did his thing too. But,
sure.
So how old were you when you saw, like, Blazing Saddles? Were you out of high school? Or
I am trying to think. I think it was one that my parents also wouldn't necessarily let me watch until they knew I could get it. Also, like, Rocky Horror, they wouldn't let me see for a long time, which was weird. I think, I want to say I was 16, like 15 or 16, so 95 or 96. And it fucking blew my mind.
Yeah.
And it was not... in any way because of the use of the N-word, as mind-blowing as that was and as funny as that was for the shock of it and not hearing it and knowing it was, like, you know, a quote-unquote dirty word or whatever, but, like, the use of it. And, it blew my mind and just changed the way I thought about everything to the point that that second I became a satirist, at least in some small way.
Right, absolutely, right.
Like, because I remember that same, I think it was that summer or the summer right after it, I remember going to the fair in upstate New York. And there's, I don't know if you've ever been on the swing ride. It's just a bunch of swings on the big thing.
It spins you around,
we're standing, and my friend Dan, we're just sitting there waiting to get on the swing ride. There's this grandmother, clearly a grandmother, and her little 6-year-old kid standing there. And then she's looking over at the ride, and she's like, she turns to her husband, "Oh, did you notice there's a colored man running the ride?" And I'm like, her grandkid's sitting right there. And I just turned her. I'm like, "Yeah, you better be careful. Your kid might catch black." And like, and that was the second I was initiated. I fell into the same club, and I'm like, "All right, that was a thing for me."
Wouldn't it? You know, I think we all agree how funny and hilarious that movie is, and Cleavon Little is hysterical too.
So good.
But if Richard Pryor had done Bart too, I think we get a little different movie, and I think really special.
Yeah.
And I would love to have seen that.
Yeah, I wonder how he would have played it. I don't know if he would have played it up. Because, I mean, Cleavon Little comes at it with, like, he's Broadway trained.
Yeah.
He's, like, very handsome.
Polished, yeah.
Yeah, and he's like, you know, they made him the sexy, hip black
guy. Yeah.
Like, they had the polished urbanite, or whatever they called him in the movie. You know, what is it? Dazzling urbanite like yourself. Doing it in a rustic setting like this. Oh, such a good line.
Yeah.
But, but Richard Pryor, I mean, not that he wasn't as polished, I mean, you know. But, I can't imagine, but it would have been, pardon me, it would have been amazing.
Yeah.
I think you could make the argument with Pryor that he was the beginning of the end of, like, of vulgarity, because you listen to it now and it's still pushing the limits.
Sure.
He got to the end of the wall there. You can't go further.
I think
further.
So. I think you're 100% right there.
You can go further where you don't earn it. I mean, you can get so disgusting where you don't earn the laugh and it's like, okay, well,
you can
it's
become
not
Andrew
there.
Dice Clay.
But yeah. And it wasn't, that's not really earned. But right. He earns it and he's right there. You can't go any further, I think.
He was this quintessential 70s comedian, you know, that really, like, he lived in Berkeley, counterculture was his thing, and he was involved. And so, you know, about 1979, 1980 is when there became this huge proliferation of comedy clubs all over the country.
Yeah.
Every small town. That's how I, like, kind of, one of the ways I paid my way through college was I could go for the weekend to Columbus, Nebraska, and Fremont, Nebraska, and MC or do a middle spot or something for some headliner and make money. There were little comedy clubs. And, you know, so many people were imitating the famous comedians at the time, or you know, you develop your character, but you could tell there was a Pryor here, or a George Carlin there, or a Bob Hope, you know, if you really, you know, wanted to try to push it and stuff. I mean, there were guys who just literally sat there and did old jokes.
Wow.
You know, and they got paid, you know. And
that's
so
funny.
And so at that point, America got exposed, because then they started the TV shows.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of...
Evening at the Improv.
Evening at the Improv was kind of the first big one where you saw comedians, you know, on TV, you know, in their essence, and they did more bleeping than cutting out. You got more of a sense of what it was like to be at a comedy club.
Yeah.
Suddenly, you know, besides there was a comedy club in every town and then on TV. So now you got to see what it was, you know, and so it was harder, I think, to kind of push through as an original, you know, because so many people were copying. And also, you know, people got to know what it was.
Sure.
And I think, I hope we can say people got a little bit more sophisticated, at least took a step up in the sense of you couldn't just go and do Richard Pryor bits, at the time, you know, get away with it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of, fucking, what's her name? Rosie O'Donnell actually got, like, discovered doing a Jerry Seinfeld set. She didn't tell anybody else what she was doing. She got discovered through a talent contest, but she just did wall-to-wall Jerry Seinfeld. You couldn't get away with that.
There's a story of, you know, Robin Williams is famous among the comedy world for stealing bits.
Right.
Only he'd like see you do something and he doesn't remember who said it, where said it.
Right.
He'll be on stage and he throws it out. And the story is with him that, like, you know, if you saw him doing your bit, you'd say, "Hey, Robin, you know, that was my, you know, parachute bit." "Oh, okay, man." And he'd like give you $50. And then there's a story, if you're broke, you just say, "Hey, Robin, that Barracuda bit was mine too." "Oh, okay, here's $50. Like, he didn't know where he got it from or where it came from or anything too. So I don't know. No, that's the, you know, that's at least the myth that goes around the comedy world when I first moved here in the early 90s and stuff, you know.
I was born in Peoria, Illinois. That's a city, nigga. You probably wouldn't know nothing about that, see? Old country ass boy. And when I was little, there was an old man, his name was Mudbone, and he dipped snuff, and he'd sit in front of the barbecue pit, and he'd spit. See, that was his job. I'm pretty sure that was his job, because that's all he did. But he'd tell stories, fascinating stories, see? He was fascinating. And I loved him. Made me very happy, because I'd stay with him and listen to this stuff. See, you're lying some when you listen to old people. They ain't all fools, see? You don't get to be old being no fool, see? So, a lot of young wise men, they're dead in the motherfucker, ain't they? So,
that TV stuff, it was a great way for A&E, Comedy Central, to fill programming.
Yeah.
We're going to throw a camera in the back of the...
Yep.
We're going to do four
Rick
shows
Wall.
Tonight, and here you go. There's 4 half-hour shows.
Yeah.
You don't have to do anything.
And we realized, even my friends and I, you know, who were doing comedy and doing sketch comedy and stuff like that, it dawned on us, hey, wait a second. You know, we've got bits we've polished over 2 years, and now we're going to throw it on some show. Basically give it to them for a couple $100, things that, you know, we've really worked on and stuff. And it kind of... you know, takes away your... They haven't written jack shit.
Right.
You know,
right,
they're getting programming, you know, from comedians and stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, I guess in one way, you're getting all this exposure if you're on TV. Fine, great, fantastic, but you just killed your material.
Absolutely, right?
Yeah, that's insane.
You know, how do you travel now if you're a comedian? You go, oh, great, you know, I've done this, and then people start going, wait a second, I just saw that bit on, you know, Evening at the Improv last week, don't you? And that's always what people want to see is new material.
Yeah.
Although, you can kind of tell in some of Richard Pryor's, he stopped doing Mudbone, you know, one of his characters, because I'm sure he just got sick of people yelling, Mudbone!
Right.
Well, comedians now, a lot of them are pushing the envelope. Louis C.K., Patton Oswalt, they both throw away everything and start every year.
Start fresh.
They have a whole hour every year.
Yeah.
Paul F. Tompkins, every time you see him, he's at new 20 minutes. It's like,
how
all
the
completely
fuck does
new.
Anybody do
it's
that?
It's ludicrous, but...
I don't get it. I mean, in one way, I mean, comedy's hopefully evolving, but it's not bit-based as much as it used to be, or at least not clearly bit-based. It's not like, here's my bit about airline food, necessarily. It's like, here's this long... It's more like since, you know, how long-form improv developed short-form, it's talking... Not at the audience, hopefully. That's shitty comedy. But, you know, having a conversation, hopefully, with the audience. But like
lectures.
No. Yeah, right. Well, sometimes they come across that way. But supposedly Louis C.K. goes on stage with no notes whatsoever. 100%.
That's
and he's like, I've got
conscious.
An idea. I'm just going to go do it. And he tests it that way. Sure, he polishes it.
Right.
But he still doesn't write down what he polished. How the fuck do you do that?
Without recording it. Yeah, that takes a special kind of comedy brain to do that stuff.
Yeah.
He's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
He's pretty amazing.
I mean,
you know, he keeps getting these shows, and they just don't catch with people and stuff.
Sucks.
Underappreciated, you know, because this is a
they're
funny
amazing.
Guy.
Yeah.
Really funny guy.
He's brilliant. Like,
but he's one, sorry to interrupt you, one of these people also who talks about, he pushes the issue of race, even as a white guy.
Right.
He pushes the issue of homophobia as a white guy, and he brings this up in a lot of interviews, too, like Richard Pryor, where he would bring up to his friends, Louis C.K. brings up to his friends, why does this offend you? Tell me the reason why, if I say... faggot. Why does that offend you? He actually asks them, and then they bring it up, and they have these great conversations about it.
Sure.
And it's wonderful. And you know, knowing this, knowing where he goes from A to C, when he says the jokes, you are now, okay, he earned it. He earned where he got there.
Right.
And we realize where it is. And it's the same thing with Richard Pryor, because he earned it. He got there. He went from A to C. He worked it out.
But it also makes you wonder, you know, when he stopped, like, he made the funny thing is he stopped using the N-word.
Yeah.
But he's going to throw motherfucker out there all the time, you know. But you can understand where he's coming from. And I had friends who had a problem, you know, a guy who I was in the military with who was African-American. And, you know, every now and then somebody would, like, be joking around or something, and then somebody would throw the N-word at him and stuff, thinking, oh, we're pals, we can, you know. And he went off on some people and said, look, you know, I'm not giving you permission, you know, to say that.
Right.
You know, I mean, you can see where somebody is coming from. And, you know, to know that even, you know, Pryor had this epiphany, you know, but he still, you know, that's kind of the only thing, because nothing was off limits with him,
right.
You know, to see that, you know, something clicked, you know, from this visit to Africa that he took.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he's not going to use it anymore. So it's very interesting, you know, the aspect of this really amazing person.
Yeah.
You know, we were listening to the bit, When a Woman Leaves You, and knowing that this is a guy who was married 7 times to 5 different women, you go, oh, you know there is, you know, 90% of truth in what's going in there, that he's just playing out stuff that happened to him.
It's so true. I mean, do you think, to listen to that, obviously... Comedians are usually contrarians. Comedians are usually kind of bipolar in that, you know, like something, a flip can get switched like that. Sure, it's different for him. There's a whole cultural thing for him where he goes to Africa, maybe has a discovery, and just makes a conscious decision, you know what, this is stupid. I'm not going to say this anymore. But then, like, there's a bruised heart in there, like there is for every comedian.
Yeah.
Is that what, I mean, do you ever think that that's part of what attracts you to listening to a comedian like that? Is there, like... heart, for lack of a better word, or because
it's so hard to peg and just say, you know, because he did speak to me, but you know, we have no similarities. This is a guy whose mom left him when he was 10 and is raised in a brothel, and you know, and the stories that you read is, you know, he's beaten, you know, daily by the grandmother and the, you know, 4 siblings and all, and you know, it got in the army, I think, when he was 19. And then spent most of the 2 years in the army in prison because they got mad at some guy at some, they were at some, you know, base movie, and some guy was laughing a little too hard at like some racist humor in some movie and stuff, and they like beat the crap out of this guy.
Holy shit.
So he basically spent most of his 2 years in military prison.
Wow.
So this is as a young man, you know, and you're kind of, you're going, how does that guy Mm-hmm. How is that guy going to end up on The Tonight Show?
Right.
You know, where he's come from, you know, to think that he had the wherewithal to go, okay, because then when he finally does become a comedian, he, you know, like Bill Cosby is his hero. He's a very clean cut, straightforward, you know, I'm sure there was this level of characters, and this is just a funny, charismatic guy. But we were talking about the story where finally it was in 67, he's at the Aladdin, and he's looking out, he walks out, and there's this audience, he's like, they say, Dean Martin's in the audience, he goes, what the fuck am I doing? And he walks off, and that's when he turned his whole material base around and that's became, insane. You know, pushing the edge on, you know, controversy and, you know, what he was talking about. And, you know, he loves to talk about, you know, the ladies and getting pussy and...
man, are we going to have a revolution like that again? Because, you know, Carlin took off the suit. He took off the suit.
Yeah.
You know, Lenny Bruce never took the suit off, but he changed tactic at some point. Like, there's... Where have we gone since then?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because they tried to have... and you guys are a little too young, you know, in the early 90s, and it's some of the comedians hanging around with Brian Posehn and Patton Oswalt and Jack Black. Alternative comedy is what they called it. And eventually my buddies and I, we came with their alternative comedy means you wear shorts. You know, I mean, that was the revolution. I mean, but granted, you talk about those guys who were doing, who are doing like stream of consciousness. You know, it's funny because Paul F. Tompkins, you know, wears a tie and it makes him stand out now.
Sure.
You know, I mean, that's his suit and tie is his thing. And he's always, I met him in 92. He's always done that too. Really? That's Paul F. Tompkins, you know, that's his... That's no shtick. That's the guy, you know, and it's funny. You remember that about him, you know?
Sure, sure.
But this was the beginning of the rock star era for comedy. This was the arenas.
Right.
Him and Carlin pretty much became such huge names in themselves. You know, Pryor and Carlin, you know, were like, you know, that it was like the handing off of, you know, Lenny Bruce, he, as a kid, and since I'm, you know, virtually 20 years older than you guys, you know, I never got exposed to any Lenny Bruce in, you know, middle America. They weren't, you know, they weren't putting him out there. He had to have gotten an album or something, which I didn't get. But these guys, you know, seeing where, you know, where they took it from, I consider that Bob Hope era, you know, or those guys. I know there were the Catskills, you know, guys too, who ended up on The Tonight Show, you know, who were basically just, you know, doing bits. Probably they'd done for 10, 20 years and all, too. But when you see some of those older guys, too, like David Steinberg, very funny guy.
Oh, yeah.
And who's the other guy with the big nose? Dave, I can't even remember. But, you know, again, seeing you know, these comedians who were pretty hilarious, but just not pushing the edge. They were funny people.
Right.
You know, but not taking it somewhere kind of crazy and new like Pryor and Carlin did.
I don't mind women leaving me, though, see? But they tell you why. Yeah, fuck that. Just leave. Right, because there ain't shit you can say when they're talking to you. Right, you know it's true. All you can do is stand there and look silly, right? You be going... And shit gets too thick, right? Niggas got a great answer. Well, fuck it then! Take your shit and get out. Yeah, motherfucker, pack this shit. You packing shit. Pack this motherfucking shit. You fucking with me, goddamn. I don't give a fuck. You put it under your drawers. I don't give a fuck where you put this shit. Shit, I'm gonna find me some new pussy. Women come back at your ass, all right? You know, you had 2 more inches of dick, you'd find some new pussy here.
Over to sketch comedy because that's my expertise, but it doesn't really make any sense to you. But I mean, like, well, the Smothers Brothers, you know, I can't stop talking about them.
Yeah.
Obviously, they go from fake clean cut, sure, but they go from like semi clean cut and actually in their real lives pretty straight edge to at some point Tommy has this whole revelation where, you know, I'm not the only person on the planet. And like, just I can't remember exactly what it was, what injustice it was, how he got pulled away by the police or whatever, but you know, he felt some sort of kinship with the rest of humanity and all of a sudden had to like everything change. You know, I don't know, like,
but I think if you're talking about sketch comedy in the sense, you can take that to the prior movies,
sure,
you know, and
sure.
say, you know, so now he's not by himself in front of the crowd getting laughs. And I mentioned to you what I thought were kind of his maybe best known and best received movies is Stir Crazy and
Silver Streak. Yeah,
you know, and you know, but they're not movies that I like throw in the DVD player or anything. You know, right. I know I remember laughing and stuff.
Sure.
Because besides those two, there's a lot of dogs in there.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and
which I think was drug money. A lot of it had to have been coke money.
Right.
You know, and I mean,
right.
he would have admitted that to any. I mean, after this wasn't the end of it, was it? I mean, 75, he was still.
No. Definitely.
When did his hair get set on fire from Freebase?
That was 80. That was 1980. Okay, so it was five years later was the Freebase incident.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then he did Live on Sunset Strip after that because he does the joke about him. He takes the match and says, "What's this?
He
Richard Pryor, you know?"
Yeah. Isn't that the cover of the album, too? Isn't
yeah.
It? I think
probably.
A drawing of it, if I remember correctly, a drawing of him and his hair.
You know, so he, again, you know, this is a guy, he makes fun of this horrible incident, you know, and he's going, "I know what you're saying about me," you know, and it's just to see and know that he has that way of looking at things, you know, and he puts himself in other people's shoes, you know, like he does with his characters,
you know,
that, you know, his movies were big, but he should have been a huge movie star.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you know, he was a name, but it didn't transfer, or I think, you know, who knows what was going on drug-wise with him.
Right.
And to try to get him, you know, there's so much money involved in movies that I'm sure there were producers who wanted him to do a set script, and he probably just wanted to be himself.
Right.
And who knows under what, you know, influences on top of that.
Yeah.
You know, alcohol or drugs or, you know, people telling him, "You're Richard Pryor, why are you listening to those guys and stuff?" And I'm sure that's what led to it not really transferring as well as it should have, you know, because there's some funny moments and all, too, but... Yeah. You know, for being such a hilarious guy and for being this great stand-up, you would hope it would transfer into movies and stuff, too. But it never, besides, like, I mean, in those days, we went and saw the concerts at the movie theater.
Sure,
you know,
right.
I mean, there wasn't, you know, I saw Live on Sunset Strip, you know, at the big theater in Omaha and just laughed so hard.
Awesome. That is so good. I would love, see, that's the thing is, like, I was thinking about this today, is that I listen to a couple other podcasts, like The Nerdist, which is a great podcast. They talk about stand-up a lot.
Uh-huh.
And I'm realizing, like, I don't think I've ever really seen... The only stand-up show I've ever seen outside of the Smothers Brothers a couple years ago is just a show they just did with a bunch of Conan's writers while
uh-huh.
I was between
shows.
Oh,
right.
Did you go to that? Yeah. So good.
Was that fun?
So good.
Yeah.
But I just really haven't seen it, and it's one of those art forms that I think is under... For me, in my own world, it's just not part of how... Even though the first comedy albums I ever listened to were all stand-up.
Yeah.
It's not something I ever gravitated to. I just gravitated to the idea of making jokes and how you can be funny
right.
with things, you know?
Yeah, that whole, it's such a different world, because I did prefer working in sketch comedy too, that the difference of going and just being, you know, a monologist, you know, and just, you know, throwing, you know, thoughts out there and trying to craft jokes and trying to make it, you know, seem natural and to seem real is, it's such an art form,
and
difficult to do well, and there's so many who do it not so well.
Sure.
That, you know, it sometimes is where you just feel like, I don't want to be another one of those guys doing bad stand-up.
Right, it's really hacky. I mean, I know, I can remember, actually, that's not true. Now I'm recalling, I did see another stand-up show, but it's only in the back of my head. I have no idea why I was there. And I remember every comic being bad.
Yeah.
Every comic busting out, just like, we're in L.A., so let's make a bunch of Mexican jokes.
Right.
And it was just like, I don't care.
Right.
You know, making Mexican, you can do what you want, but Richard Pryor clearly had experience with... There was a life built into all this material. It's not a guy just trying to make jokes. It's a guy who had some shit inside him that needed to come out, and the way it came out was in the form of jokes.
Yeah.
It's the only way he could deal. And I think most good comedians are like that. You know, they've got something built inside them that, I don't know your personal life too well, or yours that well, Mike. I'm pointing to both of them, by the way. But to be honest, like, you know, I've had my own shit, and I know that's the reason I want to be funny.
Right.
You know, whether it's the whole everybody love me, I don't care. It comes out as jokes.
I've always maintained that mine was, you know, being the product of seven children. And,
sure.
you know, if you didn't, like, you know, stand on your head and do a dance, you know, there wasn't anybody looking at you and stuff.
I
do
it for pussy.
Richard Pryor. But that is, you know, it's all about, you know, wanting to find a way to attract, you know, the opposite sex or the same sex, depending on your, you know, wherever you're going from. Of, you know, just wanting to make people laugh is to want to get the attention, whether it's to get, you know, to get laid or.
Yeah.
Well, I remember my freshman year in college, my first acting class I ever took, the first day,
the professor, Dr. Claude File, brought in live on Sunset Strip, and we watched.
Really? Really? He was my teacher too. I love that guy. Awesome. He's one of my favorite actors.
And you're just like, he's like, this is how you perform. He's like, acting is this. He's he's doing a stand-up character.
Right.
And this is that how is he it. Do it. And he's like, and if you can figure this, like, this is basically how he boiled it down. And he always said, the person you are is 10 times more interesting than anybody you're going to try to be, anybody pretend to be as an actor.
Right.
He's like, and this is, he's playing himself. He's still playing a character.
Sure.
That it's not just about being funny. Like, you can write great jokes, but if you can't perform it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's...
That's a very good way
of putting it. Well, yeah, and I think people run into that too, you know, whether you're going to be able to sell a joke. You might have the best joke out there, but if you don't know how to tell a joke on top of
it. And if it's not it for you, as your persona, I hate to say that, but trying to figure it out and be like, here, this is a joke for you because this doesn't work.
Right. Yeah, hand it off, right? Yeah. I can't sell this one, but I know it's a good joke, so you can try to get somebody to put it out there.
Are there, I mean, does it still, I mean, I don't know how much you know, of the stand-up world now, but I mean, is it still like an issue? Are there some guys who are just like, they do their own shit, but they are still like selling jokes out of their pocket to comedians? Does anybody do that anymore?
I couldn't tell you. I'm so out of the stand-up comedian loop for like 10 years now. You know, when I moved here in the first... I've been here 19 years.
Yeah.
You know, and the first, definitely the first 8-9 years, I was, you know, involved and seeing people and going to have friends who were... I have no idea what they do in the last 10 years. I mean, I have a couple buddies who every now and then go and, you know, perform down at the Improv.
Yeah.
Or I guess up at the Comedy Store, you know, but it's such a weird, it seems like such a weird world to me now.
Yeah.
You know, like who goes to a comedy club? Like you were saying, you know, it's like, do you have to do?
I guess I want to now, but it's more of a thing where I feel like I'm missing out, but I just know that I know. Okay. For instance, like I watched that Comedians of Comedy. Did you see the documentary?
I watched many episodes.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
that's right.
I watched the documentary one, and then I watched the final show of the tour.
Yeah.
And, like, I loved both of them, and I sat through both of them. But at the same time, like, there's a part of my brain that's like, I have seen this before, and I'm afraid of zoning out, I guess. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's so hard.
From which angle? As an audience member, or
as an audience member? From the audience, because a lot of the same bits were just 100%, you know, word for word, obviously, but there, some of the bits, I think, were, like, behind the scenes in the documentary, and some, you know, maybe they're working them out or whatever, but they're on stage.
So what you're talking about is that almost mundane thing of having to be able to do a routine and get it out there and seeing what it's like for them. And that's, I think, you know, I think that's what a band experiences. And really, you know, Styx goes, do we have to do, you know, come sail away again? You know, it's like, holy crap. You know, if you don't do it, people get mad and stuff.
Yeah. And, I mean, but I'll listen to a song again, but there are times if it's a shit joke, you know, if it's one of your bad jokes, like your two or three really good jokes are going to stick out for me. The other songs or track, I don't care.
That's
right. I don't want to hear them again.
Yeah.
You know, for the most part, and I don't want to be a dick about it, so I don't want to be a bad audience.
I don't know if people should see that, because that is life on the road, you know, is the beauty of that show.
That's
you know, if you want to know what it's like, you know, it is not fun, especially, you know, unless you're, you know, Leno does, shows here and there, you know, or Seinfeld goes and does a big, but for the average comedian, you have to be able to live that life on the road.
Yeah.
You're hoping you're with a couple guys, you know, or girls who you get along with.
Sure.
And, you know, it's 2 hours on stage, and then it's like trying to kill another 22 hours. You know, what do we do? And I enjoyed that. And those guys are so hilarious.
Oh, God, they're geniuses.
Yeah.
Regroup on a woman, Jack, you know. Because they outthink our ass. But we outreason them motherfuckers, see? If we get 2 minutes, all we gotta do is get 2 minutes, but it's hard to break them motherfuckers up when they get a roll going. They leave you in the middle of the floor babbling, baby. You have to go to your psychology bag on the ass. Hey, baby, hey, wait, fuck all this arguing, you know what I mean? Let's just be cool, all right? Just take your time and pack your shit. All right? Take your time, pack your shit. Put your shit in the bag. Is that bag gonna be big enough? Because if not, you can use one of mine. Right. You cool? You got money and everything? Because I guess you don't need no money? You cool? Good. No, what do you mean why am I being... I just wanted to be right. Shit, I can't make you stay if you want to leave. You just go ahead and pack this. You understand? We started off as human beings. I wanted to end that way. You know? All you have to do is find another way out of here other than that door.
Because you try to leave me, bitch, I'm going to kill your ass. I put the motherfucking bag down. I said put the goddamn bag down.
I had an amazing experience at a comedy club here in L.A. My mother came to visit. We went to see a late night taping, a late show taping, and the warm-up comedian was like, hey, come to the Comedy Store tonight. Everyone here gets free admission with your tickets. Still two-drink minimum. So we showed up. Mom didn't want to go. I'm like, I'm from Mom, I don't want to go. Right. She drags me. She's visiting. Yeah. We go.
Let's go see the comedians.
Chris Rock showed up and did an hour out of a notebook of all new stuff that he had, was trying out.
Nice.
To a room of 15 people.
You know, I guess you know what you want to say, oh, I go see crap. But when you see somebody like Chris Rock, you know, there's somebody who can craft a stand-up joke.
And when you see someone like Chris Rock in front of 15 people at the Comedy Store, he's like, I'm trying stuff out.
Right.
Looking at his notebook going, nope, not going to try it. This one will work. And then he turns to us and I'm starting the joke.
Yeah.
Awesome. It was like awesome. It was ridiculous. Oh, it was amazing. So
good. That's a good experience there. Oh. But, you know, he's somebody who you can listen to prior and you know that this is someone who he listened to as a kid. You know, he's just a couple years younger than me, 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. But I know he was listening to those same albums, and I think he's a New York or New Jersey guy or something. I'm not sure. So, you know, he's somebody who I love and feel like can craft a joke.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you hear his stories about being wasted again on, you know, his movies, you know.
He's one of the same people. His movies are just...
Yeah, it can't make it, like, click and stuff.
And they're written by the same fucking... Like, Louis C.K. writes half of his shit.
Right.
And he's a genius.
Good people. And
I don't know if they're trying so hard to fall into the mold or if it's a producer end thing where they get
My guess is that it gets so hard to water it down and too many chiefs spoil it, you know?
Yeah.
Probably if Chris Rock could make his own movie, if somebody would just give him $50 million, you know, you're going to get something decent. But as soon as somebody else starts muddying it up or watering it down, you start getting, you know, any Richard Pryor movie or something that isn't going to be him. That's true. Funny enough that, you know, to see him, to see Pryor do his thing. You probably, you know, if Richard Pryor was just coming into his heyday now, he'd have a reality show, and I guarantee you, you'd watch that, because that's a train wreck on top of this hilarious guy.
Yeah, it would have killed him earlier, probably.
Probably, right?
I mean, and not to only talk about black comedians, but, like, Eddie Murphy is another example of a guy who clearly, you know, he took a lot of what Richard Pryor did, but he did it in his own way.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's a lot of cockiness, because the guy was on fucking SNL when he was 19.
Right.
Of course you're going to be cocky.
Right.
And you're performing in front of all these people, but, like, he's a guy who had an amazing movie career and started out really strong and now is doing, you know, Daddy Daycare.
Yeah.
And, like, he's talking about maybe doing stand-up again and also talking about maybe doing another Beverly Hills Cop but making it PG-13. So, like, that just shows where he's gone. No. You can't do that.
That's too bad, but definitely a, you know, a super talent as far as stand-up went for his day, you know, as a performer.
But what the hell happens?
But I don't know.
I mean, you can still do the kid-themed things and make it funny to an extent, but he doesn't like The Toy.
Yeah.
The Toy, I mean...
I grew up on that.
That movie was amazing, but it was still...
I don't know if it's good. I haven't watched it in forever. I loved it when I was 3.
But it wasn't Daddy
Richard
Daycare.
Pryor?
Yeah.
Richard Pryor. Yeah, you're right.
The Toy,
you're right.
You know,
yeah,
I mean...
Toy.
It wasn't a kid's movie, but kids could watch it.
It was a Kubrick. The director was somebody big, though, right?
Yeah,
it was a big name.
Somebody
who'd been trying to get it done and for, like, you know, 10 years had tried to get the movie made and stuff.
Holy
it was
shit.
One of those. Could never. And I remember being excited about that movie coming out and stuff. You know, and Jackie Gleason, I think, was the dad.
Yeah, Jackie.
You know?
Yeah.
And,
that was just awesome. Still to this day, I watch Brewster's Millions maybe once a month.
Do you really? Once a month? We were just talking about how horrible a movie that
is. I love that movie.
That's so interesting.
I haven't seen it in forever.
Because I said in my mind, I definitely went opening weekend. And it's John Candy and Richard Pryor. I mean, you know, that's like gold, right? And I just remember walking out going, you know, it made me laugh a couple times, but didn't kind of transfer. But you were at the right age probably when it came out, and you, like, you know, it probably hit you in a right dead center.
Something
for
about
what
it.
Needed.
I just love thinking about what you would do with that money.
Right.
Of course.
It's like, in that, I think it's just the idea of that that gets me more than anything.
Yeah.
And I've tried to read the novel recently. It's originally a novel.
Really?
Yeah, it's old, right?
It's old, public domain.
Yeah,
it's really old. Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's remake this
thing. There's been 8 movies.
Yeah, there have. It's
Bruce's
been remade and
remade.
Are
you kidding me?
Yeah.
It's 7 or 8 plays, movies, everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Little Bow Wow?
I guess it has to be a black guy now. I'm sorry, Bow Wow. I apologize.
He goes to USC.
Does he?
Yeah.
Does he really?
Yeah.
How old is Bow Wow?
I don't know.
Does he call himself that when he goes to class?
I think he's just Bow Wow.
There's any a lot questions of... from the class? Yes. Mr. Bow Wow.
Is Bow Wow, he's Master P's son, right? Yeah. Is that? Okay, yeah. There's all kinds of weird stuff going on there. Because he got a basketball scholarship to USC, and then they found out... Like, there was something shady going on because it was, who's the guy who plays for Memphis? It was, that had all the, like, got paid to go to USC. That caused their basketball program to run into all kinds of trouble. So.
O.J. Mayo.
Yeah, O.J. Mayo, yep, right, they signed together and stuff.
I'm sorry, I know nothing about sports, but the name O.J. Mayo is possibly the greatest name ever.
That would be disgusting.
Yeah, it's a horrible combination. He makes me want to puke and laugh at the same time. Wow, that's good.
I mean, very good.
So Richard Pryor.
Richard Donner.
Richard Donner.
Holy shit.
All right. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Mr. Internet told me.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Internet. Was this the first album you bought, comedy album?
I think it was. What was the other album we talked about? That N is Crazy? The N-word?
We're going
back to that.
Right.
N-word is Crazy.
Yeah, I was going to get that one too, actually. They had
hard to find us. Oh, did they? Yeah. There's a couple of them, but this is actually, I'm glad you got this one.
Yeah.
Because this is the one that really kind of stuck with me too on over a couple of them, and I bought it, and it was the same time. It's that, and then I think it was this one, and then I think... the Steve Martin, is it Let's Get Small? Let's Get Small
fucking
is the those two were the two that I sat in the room on the old record player and just probably wore the grooves out listening to.
Why this one more than the other Richard Pryor one? Does it what differentiates?
I think it was probably just sheer luck that I just looked at them and just picked one out. I don't think there was, I don't remember somebody saying to me, oh, you got to go get a Richard Pryor album. Yeah. You should hear this guy or anything. I think it was just more, I had some money in my pocket and just went, oh, I want to hear some comedy albums and stuff. And it was so much fun that I bought a few, but none ever kind of had the magic that like the Richard Pryor and Steve Martin had, they'd be good and they'd be funny and stuff. Mm-hmm. But, Bob Newhart, has some funny written bits and stuff, sure. But it's not this.
No,
you know?
It's not. I mean, he's one of those guys, he's rare, because he was a gimmick to begin with, but somehow just kept going, and I love everything he's done.
Yeah.
But it's clearly a gimmick.
Yeah, right.
It's just dude on one end of a phone call. But so good.
But I know, it keeps making you laugh, the Bob Newhart show, and then Bob, it's the same guy. They even play it at the end, is how they end the Bob, basically wakes up with Suzanne Plissett in bed and stuff, and says he has a dream, they're kind of acknowledging. It's just him. That's Bob Newhart,
They said, supposedly they'd always dreamed of making him Dave Foley's dad on news radio, and that would have been pretty much perfect. Just two guys stammering for half an hour. I would have killed to see that. Oh my god. I'm trying to think. Well, Mike, I mean, we haven't actually talked about this. Like, have you ever what comedy album? Do you ever buy any, or is it just strictly using your parents' collection, I did?
Yeah, I used my parents' collection, and I didn't even know that they were ever into comedy until when I realized they had records upstairs
in the attic,
and I was into the hip hop.
Right.
So to me, it was a wooka 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 wooka. I could do the scratching, scratching. No. But then you listen, I was like, Bill Cosby? I like the Cosby Show.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Put it on and listen to it. Listen to Richard Pryor. And it wasn't until I was in college that I realized that reciting a lot of these Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy jokes were really racist for a white guy to do. And I'm like, and the black guys do this. And I'm like telling my white friends, I know we were 15, 14 years old. You don't realize. You're like, it doesn't really come off there.
We went to, I remember, I was out here visiting friends, and we went with my brother's, my friend's little brother, who was probably 10 at the time, and he starts doing one of the Eddie Murphy things, Eddie Murphy doing the Honeymooners. Do you remember that?
Oh, no.
I'm going to fuck you in the at the Padres game. I'm like, oh, holy God, shit. I'm going to fuck you in the ass.
That's like, awesome. Holy shit. Oh my God.
Really simple Eddie Murphy bits about that I was doing that I'm like, if a white guy says this, it's so racist.
Right.
The bit where he's like, do you know why black guys have white palms and feet? Because this is the position God puts us when he spray paints us. And I'm like doing that joke.
Yeah.
It's like,
funny.
You can't do that.
When did you realize it was quote unquote?
Oh, years later. I was doing these in the open, loudly,
because you feel like you know these guys when you hear these good comedians. I know Richard Pryor. I could do his jokes, and I'm sure, again, that's some of the epiphany that he had, because I'm guessing people walked up and said, hey, you're one funny in, you know? And right. It's like, I'm sure that just would drive you nuts. Yeah. You go, no, I've not entitled you to sit there and use that word. I know I use that word, and I use it about me, and I use people I know. But you are not entitled, you know, as a white guy from Omaha to come up to me and start throwing that out at me. And I'm sure it was happening all the time.
You're probably right. And dudes be trying to talk a lot of shit on cocaine, too, right? Be thinking they making plenty of sense. Don't be saying shit.
I'd be shit. I Nixon shit in my shit, goddamn.
And the pimps get psychotic when they get high. Them motherfuckers get all the moves together, right? Shit, I'm not, I got a little girl, you know what I mean? I'm not. Now the men scream on me and say, I'm not a man, you know? I got 500 million, you know? Talking about the men, now I got a man on. I'm not the one on the line, you know? I'm on the, over in the car, there. No, name this mess. I don't do no more. I'm gonna hold the mess. I ain't holding the motherfucking man. Yeah, so I'm gonna get it, huh? No, yeah. I'm ready for Freddy. You know what I mean? And now,
niggas be holding them dicks too, Jack. White people go, why do you guys hold your things? So you done took everything else, motherfucker.
An easy target.
Yeah.
A recognizable dude.
Yeah.
Was there anybody, I mean, I'm not going to stick on race the whole time. Is there anybody of color in your school, Mike?
Yeah. One. And one he, guy. He's one of my best friends, and he was actually a groomsman in my wedding. Like, uh-huh. The one.
Did he hear you? Did he hear you making these cracks?
Yeah.
Was he okay with it?
Well, yeah, because I think he knew that it was comedy, and he knew where it was coming from, too. Yeah.
Right, you weren't throwing it out to be racist. Exactly. You just heard a funny bit.
And we were all reciting these bits.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And it's not racist, but if you were walking on the street and heard me and a couple of my buddies just reciting this stuff,
right.
You'd be like,
right, out of context.
Yeah, well,
horrible,
no one
right?
would be upset because of the town I grew up in. That I'll be like, yeah, right. Good job.
Right. Yeah, for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yep, same yeah. here. That's why we picked Monty
That
Python,
was supposedly the Chappelle thing was that, you know, he'd do, you know, a lot of controversial, oh. you know, racist things, and so supposedly it was like a few of the crew members just laughed a little too hard. He yeah. felt like, hey, wait a second, you know, are they laughing at us or with us?
Right.
And they say that's one of the things that drove him over the edge. Another super hilarious person, you know.
Well, I was always happy to hear that he couldn't stand the fans of his that quoted his shit mindlessly, just as I couldn't stand him. Right. That's the only reason I can't watch his show, because, like, all I can think about is those assholes who say, I'm Rich Bitch, or I'm Rich James, and over and over and over. I'm like, you've killed it for me.
But they don't get, that's not even the joke.
No.
Like, they don't get the joke. They're into it for the catchphrase.
It was brilliant satire. Really brilliant satire. But I have to actually sit down and watch it again sometime soon. To actually really appreciate it, because it was out of context for me.
It's not a show that I watched religiously, but every time I watch, I laugh.
Yeah.
I have to say that
some of the greatest sketches I've ever seen in my life, ever seen.
Yeah,
the blind KKK.
The blind KKK.
Yes,
it's the greatest.
Yes, that's a class. Maybe an all-time classic, right?
I just remember. I don't even know. What I
you
was
don't know?
Say.
Okay,
I don't
good.
Remember it. I don't.
Oh, for Chappelle, Chappelle wise and stuff.
Yeah, I was thinking we were going back into the race thing about how racist I was as a kid.
Yeah.
I did a high school talent show where I did John Leguizamo sketches from House of Buggin', and
House
I was
of Buggin',
like, I was like, Chicano militant minute. Yeah. I look back and I'm like, oh my God.
All right. I'm going to have to try to outshoot you for the, you know, unknown races. In sixth grade, went as Aunt Jemima for Halloween.
Oh, shit!
Yeah,
you got me.
Yeah. You know, hilarious. I won the costume contest, you know. And, you know, when I think back now, I go, what were we thinking? Literally, like, virtually a minstrel, you know. I mean, just, we did homemade makeup and stuff.
Holy crap.
And, you know, I did a bandana and big, you know, outfit. And,
I actually used to wear a necklace that said Africa when I was into rap.
Oh,
like, really.
My gosh.
And that was not trying to be funny. Like,
Holy shit.
It was an African necklace.
What about, like, Sacha Baron Cohen, you know, when he's doing, is it Bruno? No, he has the...
Ali G. Yeah.
You know, it's pretty funny. And could be, you know, taken by the wrong person as racist, too, because, you know, you're not quite sure, you know, of his ethnicity, of the character or not. He's a Jewish guy from England, but, you know, he comes off as he could look like he's, like, maybe partially, you know, mixed minority or something, right, too. Yeah. And, you know, he's throwing stuff out. But he's another super funny person, I think, nowadays, who I would love to see more from. And he kind of gets to do his own thing a little bit. You know, nobody gets just free reign, you know, when it comes to movie-wise and stuff.
His problem that Sacha Baron Cohen's getting right now is he had a lot of problems on Bruno that people were recognizing him and knowing it was a bit. And it was like, that's it. That's why he tried to do so much overseas.
Yeah, sure,
Yeah, I can't imagine being. I mean, he's doing. I think his next thing's narrative, although other than Queen, which I'm not. I'm in between on that one. Him playing Freddie Mercury kind of seems kind of perfect, but he also kind of drives me crazy sometimes. So I don't know. It's like, oh.
But you know, I like that this.
Sweeney Todd, sorry.
Yeah, he was good. He was good.
I like this. Just kind of thinking, trying to figure out like who nowadays, mm-hmm. you know, was influenced by Pryor and
sure.
who,
oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, you wonder if somebody, I can't imagine that Sacha Baron Cohen in his formative years knew anything of Richard Pryor. I don't know, you know, growing up in, you know, England and all, and not that there weren't American albums there and stuff too, but I'd be curious to kind of ask him who his comedy influences were.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Although, you know, it's funny when I see like, Family Guy was making fun of Monty Python and stuff, talking about, kind of saying, they did this bit where they tied Meg up in the basement and they made her watch Monty Python bits. And she goes, I don't even like the funny bits. Like, they were kind of saying there's a lot of unfunny bits, which, from the old TV show, when you watch it now, you kind of go, oh, I remember laughing at everything.
Right.
You know? Right. And now I kind of just want to see the special bits and stuff.
Right, right.
You know, they're... It either, you know, it doesn't play now or, you know, isn't as good and stuff. But a lot of really smart people I know seems like they all love Python, and you have to appreciate their writing skills too.
Sure.
You know, the same way that I appreciate, you know, Pryor's ability to present a joke. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that was really his forte. It was putting the joke out there. The material itself, funny characters, you know, but he wasn't, you know, he was just. You know, he crafted the jokes themselves, how he was going to say them. But, you know, if you read a lot of these jokes just on paper, you kind of go, I'm not really seeing where the funny is.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, it is all just a matter of the presentation. The same as a bad director can fuck up a good script.
Yeah.
You know? I'm going to have to find Let's Get Small, if only because it's very different.
It is.
It's not character.
It is.
It's like the guy came from, like, a real love of, like... of performing, but of, like, you know, kind of a vaudeville thing, and he's also sort of being ironic. And
he's drumming a banjo, for God's sake. Yeah, you know, exactly. you know, who's doing that? And
now I didn't listen. Does he reference that he stole it?
We were from talking Paul about Mooney. That. Yeah. I don't know the specifics.
Maybe
of that one.
Specific line. Maybe it's just that line, the justice line. I'm wondering, he must have just jacked.
I'll bet that's what it is. That the whole theory of justice, is, you know, we don't get justice.
Here, let's let them look at the cover to see.
Here
what
you
we're
go, people.
About.
There you go. How does that look?
Now they understand.
No, they totally get it. But yeah, Paul Mooney. I keep because he's one of those guys who's kind of behind the scenes and for a lot of guys, you know. And like, I didn't know who he was until I saw Bamboozled, which I love that movie. Have you seen Bamboozled?
Yeah. He's one of those people who influences. Like, he's on everyone's influence list.
Yep.
Influenced by.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's also interesting to hear people bring up like Dick Gregory, because as a kid, to me, he was just an activist. You know, he wasn't a comedian stuff. And then I read some of his routines, who actually on paper were really funny.
Yeah.
You know, really funny stuff. And, you know, he got to the point where he was more about the cause.
Sure.
You know, as opposed to just, you know, just wanted to go out there and entertain, you know, which you can completely understand, especially if you were African-American in the 60s, you know, and going into the 70s, you know. I mean, you can see where these guys, you know, trying to help, you know, help themselves, you know, to move up and to change the world, too.
Yeah.
And when you go and somebody like Richard Pryor or you know, Dick Gregory can do that, it's pretty amazing.
Right.
You know?
Do you think, I just wonder if it with a guy like Richard Pryor or most comedians who go the comedian route and don't become activists, if it's just a matter of attention span, if it's just like, you know what, I can't sit down here and plan something and be serious for too long, it kills me.
It takes a lot of energy and effort.
Yeah.
You know, you got to wonder, how much can I put out there? And then I'm sure there's just that frustration point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what can I really do? You know, how can I, you know, change things?
You always feel like you're not helping, especially if you're in comedy, because you're like, laughs, you don't even trust the laughs sometimes, you know?
Picasso felt that every work of art was an almost an act of war. It was a political statement. Right. You know, even if you don't know where it's coming from, right. mm-hmm. if it's a legitimate work of art, it's mm-hmm. coming from somewhere politically inside you that you are
sure.
making a statement.
Right, putting it out.
Yeah. If comedians could take themselves seriously, well, you know, some of them do take themselves way too seriously, but it seems like it's one of those things, they don't trust their own material.
But it's also such a fine line with the audience, you know, sure. because you don't want to be preached to.
Of course
either.
Not.
Mm-hmm. You know, so how do you put stuff out there? And Pryor did so much to put, you know, things out there in a funny way
yeah.
that you're still entertained, you know, and still thinking, you know, and then he threw out, you know, he was raunchy too.
Yep.
And, you know, so he went on this roller coaster ride, yeah. you know, of presentation on different material, different mm-hmm. things he's talking about. And, you know, and as soon as a comedian starts getting preachy, which was, you know, Lenny Bruce's, yeah. you know, one of his downfalls, sure. you know, was, you know, people just tune out. All of a sudden, you know, mm-hmm. that's not what you want to hear.
And it's actually, you know, it's interesting you say that because, like, for me personally, it's a similar reason that I stopped listening to George Carlin because of his character changed. It wasn't necessarily, it was preachy, but the character was preachy. And he was doing that character, I think, for a reason, to reflect how the baby yeah. boomers were changing and yeah. everything. But I hated the change. Angry George Carlin, I never liked.
You wanted a little more hippy-dippy weather.
I love that shit. And you know, the last album was really good. And I probably uh-huh. appreciate it more because he just died. But
yeah.
the last album I thought was really good. And I got, you know, you can hear maybe the sensitivity in there a little bit more. But like Angry George Carlin, I was like, I don't know if... I don't know if Richard Pryor changed his character that much after he stopped using the N-word, but like, how often do they change character?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Or, yeah, you know
that's
what?
A big risk.
Again, a lot of it is, you know, it's all based on how long do I want to sustain this?
Sure.
Do you need a change? You know, that's with the bands, you know, when they're doing songs, you know, they sure. want to try something. And you know, there's such a fine line of the audience wants to see. You know, the characters that we know,
yeah.
you can't venture too far. But if you just give them the same thing, then they're bored. So you got to kind of find that
yeah.
middle ground of how can you evolve or yeah. how can the material evolve without, like, disenfranchising people or right. you know, throwing people off, you know?
Yeah. I mean, George Carlin was lucky in that he had, he wasn't just lucky, he was brilliant, but, like, he had HBO. He's the first guy to yeah. have HBO as a platform. So he got to give people what they wanted, but he got to evolve that character. And if he wanted to change it, he could. And
yeah.
people at some point only knew him from that, and
right.
they only knew Angry Carlin, and
right.
that's the guy they loved. Oh, brain droppings, funniest shit yeah. in the world. And I was always like, I listened to Seven Words first. That was the thing that,
yeah.
that just,
yeah.
that fucking killed me. I had
yeah.
that thing memorized, but, you know.
Isn't it nice? You can use one of those Seven Words here, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's so nice. Oh, man.
I just hope people get it who haven't had a chance to be exposed to Pryor. You
know,
that this will open them up and stuff. You know,
who
to open up a world.
Probably only know him from his bad movies.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, that's not him.
Right.
You know, those movies are not him. This is, you know, this is the guy that kind of, you know, changed things and
yeah.
you know, took it to a whole different platform.
Well, that was the other thing, actually. That's the other thing we forgot to talk about is how different did we? I don't think we did. How different Blazing Saddles would have been with him instead of Cleavon Little.
Yeah, we did at
the
beginning.
Did
we
did talk
kind of,
about
we went
that.
Over that.
All right, I am suffering from Alzheimer's. That is fantastic. Oh, shit.
Well, he was, you know, he was also an Emmy-winning writer.
Right.
You know, as a writer, you never kind of know, like, mm-hmm. you know, what does that mean? It meant he was on for Lily, which was a Lily Tomlin show.
Oh, really?
You know, yeah. He won an Emmy, which sometimes you're on a staff writer on that show, but it would have been interesting, again, to, like, get a hold of the paperwork on that. And
yeah.
know, what was he writing on that show?
Yeah.
What wasn't making it on, I'm
right.
sure, would make us laugh our asses off,
yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
Because could you imagine being in that room, in that writer's room? I mean, that's about as fun as
it would
have
been
get.
Frenetic. Yeah. It would have been insane.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, they say Mel Brooks was when he
yeah.
was working on for your show of shows. Like,
yeah.
Just like,
yeah.
maybe annoying. Maybe to the point of annoying to everybody else. But clearly that's like genius level
yeah.
shit going on there. Because I think that's the same reason he seems like the kind of guy who just, for drugs or other reasons, couldn't get along with everybody.
Right.
He did not fit in. He did not, I mean, he didn't almost didn't work out on Blazing Saddles. He had all kinds of insane problems on Stir Crazy. Like if you read Gene Wilder's autobiography, there's this part where, and again, Gene is such a sweet guy, even Gene, like I know him, we're best friends, but you listen to him, Mr. Wilder, in the book, he talks about it, you know, I'm not sure if it was the drugs or not, but, you know, at one point, what happened? They're all having dinner, on the prison set, everybody is, and somebody chops up some watermelon, and they're having some watermelon, and two guys start playing frisbee with it. Unfortunately, it gets loose and it lands right at Richard Pryor's feet, and he just got pissed and walked off the set, took a helicopter, and left.
Wow.
Left. And clearly no reason, like, there's no logical reason. Nobody was aiming anything
right
at him.
It
was not, like,
meant to be racist or anything.
Not at all. And I mean, Sidney Poitier is a director.
Yeah.
You're not going to fucking do that on Sidney Poitier's set. So, like, he obviously just couldn't. Fit, again, drugs maybe, but like the drugs were, you know, probably trying to medicate that part of him that didn't get along with anybody. Anyway,
Stir Crazy was late 70s.
I think
like 79, and you know, it's, I'm sure it was a combination of you know, whatever he was on,
yep,
and you know, just that sense of anger, mm-hmm. you know, of, you know, the life he had led.
Sure.
And, you know, being, you know, in this, living in the 60s, I'm sure he, you know, he remembered what it was like, only being able to drink out of certain fountains,
sure.
and go to restrooms and not being able to sit at lunch counters and stuff. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that is such a foreign world to us now that we just hear people talk about,
yeah.
you know? And,
yeah.
And so I'm sure, you know, all it takes is even one drink, let alone drugs, to like get you, you know, the wrong, some watermelon lands at your feet.
Yeah.
You kind of see somebody and, you know, yeah. I'm Richard Pryor. I don't have to put up with this shit.
Exactly.
You know?
You wonder if maybe that personal hands-on experience with that kind of, I know the racism's still there. I'm not going to deny that.
Yeah.
But a lot of comics now who can still talk about the same thing and absolutely have the right, but they're getting a lot of this stuff passed down.
Yeah.
They still have the right to talk about it, but that fire is not going to burn in you, I don't think, the
right,
same way as
right.
it would in somebody like
right, who actually
Pryor.
Experienced it.
You know, and he had to say it, and he had to talk about it, because there's no reason he was getting, no way you let anybody get away with it. You had to keep talking about
yeah.
it. Otherwise, it would just get buried.
Absolutely.
And as long as everybody hears it. And I mean, in this case, like, you're listening to that, he's clearly relating really well to the audience. They love him. They're hooting and howling.
Yeah.
At moments, I might not. Maybe I don't relate, whatever. I'm not there seeing him do what he's doing. But obviously, you know, a white dude from Nebraska heard it. And sure, you know, there's the sweetening effect where you're
uh-huh.
going to laugh along with the laughs. But something must have hit you.
Totally,
you know? And, like,
totally struck. And you know, again, he painted this picture in your mind as you listened to him, you know, that just
yeah.
made you laugh. And, you know, for, you know, 98% of it, you can just see what he's doing. You know, you see him on stage.
Yeah.
And... you know, that it's amazing to have that, somebody to have that kind of charisma that he had,
yeah.
you know, I mean, that's like, that's pretty special.
Yeah. Well, it's, this has been a lot of fun.
Good.
Thank you, Mike. A blast.
I love, nothing's funnier than sitting around talking about comedy.
Right. Exactly. You know, there's nothing better than analyzing what is funny and instinctively funny. Too.
But no, it is kind of fun to, you know, to take these cultural events too, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you know, put them out there for people to, you know, you hope either, you know, exposing them to something new,
right.
or at least, you know, what I loved about your other podcast with the Smothers Brothers, had been so long since I'd sat there and listened to stuff, it just made me laugh, and I pulled up a bunch of other things,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, it's fun to kind of like, to know that you're, you know, drudging up those kind of things that
yeah.
make people laugh again. It's something they maybe hadn't listened to in a long time.
I think I want to do another Smothers Brothers one soon.
All right.
If we do, if you want to come along for
if you give me a pre-warning, because
yes.
I'm not as familiar with their stuff as I
sure.
am with other.
Well, we'll
and,
do
and,
Let's
and
Get Small,
love.
Too.
Well,
we're going
great.
To do Let's
that
Get
sounds
small.
Like a lot of fun.
Sweet. Well, this has been episode 4 of Comedy on Vinyl. Thank you to Mike Warden, producer and contributor.
I didn't know if that was my time to speak.
No, Michael.
Sorry.
God. Who the fuck do you think you are?
I didn't know if you were.
Jesus Christ.
I'm getting in my helicopter.
Follow me on Twitter, M.A. Warden. I have 7 followers now.
Don't follow him on Twitter.
Nice.
Don't listen to
nice.
Him.
I have 7 followers.
Okay, follow him on Twitter. I'll follow you tonight. Am I already following you?
I don't know.
Mike, are you on Twitter? Mike,
I am on the Twitter.
Are you? Do you want to tell people? You don't have to.
No, for the next one, I can't even remember because
remember
I don't think I've twitted in weeks now. You know, I was,
yeah.
you know what? I did it, and I have a lot more friends on Facebook.
Yeah.
And you know when it ended was the Oscars, and I had, you know, a couple of my friends, we watch it live.
Uh-huh.
And so I was doing like tweeting and some pretty good jokes,
commentary.
And I realized, hey, I've got like 10 people here. I got to go over to Facebook and put
yeah,
this
right,
in.
Right.
And there I got like the big response.
Awesome.
Oh, you're kidding me. Good one. You know, so true. And I go, oh, okay. So maybe if I get a few followers on the
right.
Twitter bug there, I'll. I think I have also like.
I'll
8.
Put a link on the blog.
Maybe we should have like a challenge for, you know, a tweeter challenge there.
We should.
And,
we should
see how many people we can get on, because that would be fun, and you know we could tweet during the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, how would that work?
I don't know. But here's the thing: it's a time machine. That's fine. People
the beauty
will
of it
no
is,
idea what the reference.
Here's what you can do: is you have people on the podcast. You know,
mm-hmm.
they tell you when they're going to start it, and
okay.
you start it at your house, and that's when you can start your tweet.
There you go.
You know?
That's a good idea.
Tweet his questions.
I like that. I like that idea.
Well, thank you to Mike Priester as well. This has been a lot of fun. Everybody have a fantastic evening. And what I don't remember. We don't have a tag to leave with. We need a tag.
Was it something we said? No, that won't work.
Grand to the old cook shop, and I tell you what'll make me growl. Boiled beef and carrots. Boiled beef and carrots. That's the stuff for your doggy gel. Makes you fat and it keeps you well. Don't live like this.
Comedy on Vinyl is recorded at Ford Awesome Studios in Burbank, California. Follow us on Twitter at Comedy on Vinyl. And follow us on Facebook, or like us at GOO.GL/VSMFZ, as in zinc.
We both settled down once more. My bells all met me in the pub. Said a fella to me, what's your friend? What did you have for your honeymoon? So just for a long I said, boiled beef and carrots. Boiled beef and carrots. That's the stuff for your dolby tail. Makes you fat and it keeps you well. Don't live like vegetarians. Both they give the parents.